Welcome to Open the Pod Bay Doors. I'm your host today, Ian Gardner. This podcast is brought to you by Innovation Bay. We are a network of tech founders, investors and connectors, and our aim is to support startups on their journey from idea to IPO and beyond. We've been doing this since 2003. We're active across Australia. We've got over 5,000 members. So if you're interested in joining us, please check us out and sign up as a member at innovationbay.com. Now, if you like this podcast, and we really hope you do, please do tell the world about us on social media. And if you're feeling super generous, you could also rate us wherever you listen to your podcast. We love hearing your feedback, so please do let us know how we're doing and who else you might like to hear on the show. Coming to you from Bondi Junction in the middle of lockdown, I'm afraid, once again, but hopefully we'll be out of it soon. So, and if you're in the same boat, I hope you're hanging in there. The good thing is we have an amazing podcast today. So James Ferguson is the CEO and founder, one of the founders of Immutable Games. Remarkable guy, like one of the smartest, most driven, with the biggest growth mindset of any founder I've come across. Pretty remarkable business. He's already at 100 staff, has raised 20 million bucks so far. They're looking to do a $100 million round now, going to be 160 staff by the end of the year. And it's basically a business that uses the blockchain to create NFTs within games. I won't spoil it. James goes deep into the details of it and why he created it and what it's all about, but an amazing, amazing business with an incredible founder. So we are really lucky to have James as part of this community, really lucky to have him on the show. He is a member of the Summit Group, so we go into that and why he did that towards the end of the show. I love doing conversations like this. I always learn. I always feel slightly inadequate when I come across people like that. I think James is still in his 20s, so just remember that when you're listening to him. So let's go and hear from this amazing founder, James Ferguson. Okay, welcome everyone. I am here with James Ferguson. So James is from Immutable Games. Welcome, James.
Thank you, Ian. Delighted to be here.
Yeah, now we should have been doing this face-to-face. I think I've said this before. I much prefer face-to-face. You get better audio quality and just a better conversation. But this is about 0.9 as good from my perspective. Hopefully from the audience perspective, it's more like 0.95. Yeah, we're still in lockdown, which is a bit disappointing. How's it going for you?
Look, we were meant to move into our brand new office in Sydney on top of the Apple Store on Monday and throw our first ever internal employee Immuticon, where like we were flying in people from all around Australia in order to do so. But now that is on hold and we're throwing Remoticon instead.
It is so frustrating. You know, and I do feel for everyone that's been impacted by this. We were just, thinking about this today as an Innovation Bay team, and we completely dodged a bullet. I mean, we put on four major events in May. We had 70 VCs in Adelaide for a week round South Star. Most of our summit members, including you, James, you came along to our little retreat in Tasmania at the end of March, and then two angel investor events, one in Sydney, one in Melbourne. If that happened now, that would not be happening, and we'd be staring down the barrel of a lot of non-refundable deposits.
Yeah, it's been very interesting. I think it's interesting. You can get a lot of quality out of different video calls and video call events. And I still think that we'll be able to throw something good. And I'm sure you guys would have been able to pull off something good in the virtual world. But there is something about that face-to-face, especially if it starts dragging on for too long. There's only so much video screen that people like.
Yeah. Anyway, unfortunately, we are not face-to-face, but I have met you plenty of times now, so I feel like I know you pretty well. And it does make it a lot easier when you can have a chat with someone that you know. Let's hear a little bit more about Immutable, because a lot of people may not have heard of it. You were previously called Fuel Games, and you know, I'll just read what was on the LinkedIn page, and then I'll let you talk a bit more about it. So Immutable provides scalable blockchain infrastructure for world-class video games, bringing transparency to the opaque world of in-game economies. So there's a lot of words in there, a few buzzwords. So it's kind of gaming, blockchain. What does Immutable do?
So instead of just giving the one-liner, which ends up being very buzzwordy, I'll go into something which is quite interesting, which is gaming as an industry is huge. Currently, gaming is about a $200 billion a year industry. And $100 billion of that is spent on in-game items which people don't actually own. So that number, just $100 billion.
So half of the gaming industry is spent on in-game items.
Yeah.
Right.
And that number is huge, right? It's more than movies and music combined. So if you think of all of Hollywood, all of the record labels, all of these streaming services, all put together, It's nothing compared to gaming.
Wow.
And the business model of gaming evolved from, it used to be back in the day, you'd head down to your local EB Games or wherever, and you'd go and you'd buy a CD-ROM or a disc and buy the game on that. And you'd pay you $30, $50, $70 or whatever it was for that. And then you'd go play the game and enjoy it. And that's not how gaming has worked for the last decade, though. For the last decade, games have switched to be free. They're pretty much, like, the vast majority of this revenue is coming from games which are entirely free. You could download them right now and start playing. And instead, they sell you in-game items. So these are games like Fortnite, where they sell you costumes for your characters to wear. And because of that, they can monetize so much better, right? You get 10 times the player base because it's free and you don't bar anyone from coming in. And then each player can spend what they're happy to spend in the game. The people who are very wealthy with a lot of disposable income will spend thousands on the game. And in fact, in some circumstances, they spend hundreds of thousands or millions of dollars on different games. And the people who are only happy to spend $50 on their items will just spend that.
Yeah, and this also includes some mobile games like Clash of Clans and a few others.
Exactly, exactly. So it's some of the mobile games which have done this best. I mean, I was speaking to some of the people who've made some of the most successful mobile titles, and one of them was telling me, I was in Game of War, they had people who spend $6 million on a game over in Dubai, like crazy numbers. And we are looking at this, and the whole business model of let's hype people up and try and, you know, convince them to buy something in a moment of excitement. And it's a bit exploitative to us because there's no property rights around these items. They just have a license to use the item for entertainment purposes only in these games. And the rest of the world doesn't work like this. In the physical world, it would be like if you could only ever rent your house, right? And you had no concept of the housing market and being able to trade houses. There's no ability for you to buy an item in these video games and then sell them for real money. And so that's what we are trying to do as Immutable. All we want to do is bring in real trading for money into these games so that playing these games and buying these items is no longer exploitative, and we can disrupt the way that video games and the business model behind video games are being run.
Yeah. And give it, so, I mean, it's fascinating, and it's not an area I'm certainly not an expert in. I don't tend to play those free to play. And certainly I wouldn't go and buy a costume for my character. It doesn't seem to actually improve performance at one's playing. But I know there's plenty of people that do. But how did it all come about? Like, how did the company get started, and who was behind it?
So I made the company with my brother 3 and a bit years ago. So Robbie and I, my co-founder and brother, have been doing ventures together, like trying to build tech projects together for quite a while, since 2014, actually.
And it's worth saying you're pretty young. So, like, how old was Robbie when he joined you in the business?
Oh, that's a good question. Robbie would have been 19, 20. Yeah, so young.
Yeah, that is super young. And you're not a huge amount older. I mean, you're still sub 30, aren't you?
Yes. I've still got 10 months left before I hit the big 30.
Well, you're doing well. So anyway, sorry, keep going.
So Robbie and I have been doing different projects for quite a while. So while Robbie was still in high school, actually, and I had just come back from Silicon Valley, where I was working, doing software engineering over there, and we were building a machine learning platform to try and do automatic A/B testing to increase the conversion rates of e-commerce sites. And we built on top of that, built a couple of different e-commerce sites on top of that. But throughout that time, we got exposed to a couple of other areas. One of the main ones being Bitcoin, which we found interesting. You know, there's some interesting stuff around the concept of digital gold. But then we saw Ethereum, where you can have programmable assets, and we got obsessed. And so we just spent like multiple years working out what can we build on top of Ethereum. And we were looking at doing, and I'm sure we'll probably dive into like the world of Ethereum later, but we looked at building out a decentralized finance product in 2017. I originally had been to law school though, and I was convinced that, you know, everything ICO-like that was going on had a bad smell to it and was probably an unlicensed securities offering, which the SEC was going to crack down on. So we didn't want to go down that path. And then at the end of 2017, we saw this project called CryptoPunks, which was the world's first NFT. It was just for art, though, right? There were these CryptoPunks, which were NFT art, and NFT stands for non-fungible token. Non-fungible meaning it matters whether you have this one or this one. They're completely unique. So the building I'm in here is a very different value proposition and item to the building across the street, right? This one's 5 stories high. That one is 3. And there's other things different about them. But this dollar or that dollar, doesn't matter which one you've got. So these people had worked out how to apply Ethereum to apply to items which were different. And we saw that and we're like, right, art is interesting-ish, but there's a lot of, you know, value and utility questions there. But if we can take this and apply it to video games, then suddenly we have something which people around the world want, and we can stop the video game business model from being so exploitative. So Robbie and I, at the time, went and we had full-time jobs at the time, but we set about building a game which used non-fungible tokens. And we actually built the world's first multiplayer blockchain game. It was a robot battling game. It was reasonably simple and proof of concept-y. It was just built by us too. But because you could actually own these robots in the game and sell them for real money, and it was the first game where you could ever do this, and there was also battling mechanics which were all on the blockchain, it launched and got a little bit of buzz, and it went really well. So it sold out its $1.5 million US dollar sale in about a week, which was enough for us to go say, let's go put this to build a business on top of this.
And what was that one called, James?
It was called Etherbots.
Okay.
So
And so you put a cap on how much how many assets were in the game. So $1.5 million, once we get that, we're not selling anymore.
Exactly. So, and what's nice is that because it was on Ethereum and on the blockchain, you can put in programmable rules that even us as the developers and the creators can't overwrite. And you don't need to trust us at any point. All that logic is encoded into the smart contracts. So
but for the average gamer, they've got no idea whether or not that is programmed in. They're not going to go behind the source code and work out whether it's real or not. So who did you rely on to give that sort of stamp of approval?
It's interesting. So it's about maybe a couple of percent of the audience is maybe software inclined or developer inclined, and they can get the information and pass it out to everyone else. And so there are a lot of gamers who are asking different developers, oh, is it fine? Is it fine? And then the developers looking into it and passing it out throughout the community.
All right. So let's keep going with the story, because I mean, it's fascinating. I want to get to where you're at now, because it's a massive business now. So, I mean, there's the two of you, you've got your first game, you've got $1.5 million in the door, you know, you must be high-fiving, but what did you do next?
So we set about and we thought about it quite strategically. We're like, we want this to be a thing. We want this to be something which is mainstream as well. What do we need to do? We raised about $2 million from companies like Coinbase. I would be the most notable one who backed us, and set about building two things. One, a mainstream appealing piece of content, which would use non-fungible tokens. So a really high quality video game rather than the proof of concept one that we made before. And secondly, a way to make trading better, because these games have trading at their core. And are you familiar with Pokemon cards or Magic the Gathering?
I am. What was the other one? Yu-Gi-Oh! I had some kids of that age.
So for us, the clear thing to build next was the first trading card game, where the cards themselves were on the blockchain, right? We get to model based on what happened in the physical world and the different things of player-to-player trading and do a lot of the different mechanics that they did and get all the benefits of a video game which is more immersive, where you can play with anyone in the world and also trade with anyone in the world at any moment in time. And that game is called Gods Unchained. It's one of Ethereum's most profitable games since we launched it in 2018. And it's actually grown a lot. And now the old head of Magic the Gathering Arena actually runs the game, Gods Unchained. So that's Chris Clay, and we pulled him over from the States, and it's been amazing to have him on board.
And is that a mobile game, or is that an Ethereum trading thing? I mean, like, how did you think of the business back then?
So currently it's desktop only, but the mobile version of the game is coming out this year. And we think that that's going to, you know, increase the player base even more. Yeah.
But I guess my question is, like, was it successful because it was just a great game, or was it successful because it had this Ethereum bolt onto it?
Awesome question. You need both. So if the game didn't have the Ethereum true trading on it, it would not have been a successful game. And if the game didn't have such a talented team spending like eight figures in develop like behind this game to make it a good game, then it wouldn't be a successful game either. You need to have both. You can't compromise on either the quality or on the fact that you actually own these assets, which is its edge.
Yeah. All right. So this is obviously super successful and did really well. So off the back of that, you went and raised a subsequent round. I think that's when we first came across each other, because you came to Venture Down Under when we put it on for the first time in New Zealand in Lake Ohau.
Is that right?
So you had that success. Yeah, well, thank you. I think you're a little bit skeptical. It's like, who is this guy trying to get me to come to this remote ski lodge with a bunch of VCs that may or may not turn up?
Yeah, and look, pleasantly surprised. But yeah, I think that was one of the first breaks I've had in about a year and a half, maybe a year and a quarter after making the company. And I think that might have been the first holiday, or I consider a holiday that I've had in that time.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. Because that was a year we actually had all the startups that stayed with us for pretty much the whole time. So you got to participate in a lot of the sessions and some of the activities. Yeah, I went skiing. And I think it was successful. I mean, like, you met a lot of the community. I think you met the Reinventure guys. So what happened after that?
So at that time, we'd been spending a lot of the time, as we built this game, we were at the limits of what Ethereum could do in terms of scalability. So we'd been looking at different R&D projects. How can we get this thing to scale and make a better user experience? Because ultimately, it needs to be seamless. It needs to be as easy and as fun as trading on Robinhood is, right? To actually interact with the blockchain. And so we were raising money to go scale the game a bit more, but also build out this part of the platform in order to do it. And we ended up raising 15 US for about 23 Aussie. This was that money came in September 2019 in the end. And with that, we started building this trading platform with Gods Unchained as its first customer. So that money ended up coming in from, it was led by Naspers or Prosus, as they rebranded to, which owns 30% of Tencent. So because of that brilliant, you know, $30 million investment that they made back in the day, they're pretty much the biggest VC in the world.
I think they're South African. Did they not have some Alibaba exposure as well, or is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So huge, huge company. And I remember when like they were writing their portion of this raise, the investor was telling us like, this is the smallest like check we've ever written. And I was looking at me like, this is more money than I've seen in my entire life.
So that's awesome. So that was late 2019. And just give us a really quick snapshot. So you must have used most of that money just to go and hire a team. So I think it was probably easier back then to hire a team than it is now. And we'll touch on that later. But I mean, you're now where with the business? You got almost 100 staff.
In that time, we had built, we went all in on a trading technology called zero knowledge rollups, which is a way that you can scale Ethereums or blockchains. And in doing so, we built the first zero knowledge rollup for NFTs. And essentially, it looks like we got the strategy right on this one, and that was the right tech to go down. Vitalik, the main creator of Ethereum, came out and said about 9 months after we'd gone down this path and we were busy building this out, it looks like the whole of Ethereum is going to be all in on rollups, and it's going to be the future of all blockchains. And in doing so, we've scaled the team up and really like operationally split it into two different sections. The Immutable Studio, which runs and builds these games, which have NFTs and trading as part of their core mechanic. And then secondly, this other B2B business or B2B2C marketplace, where we've built a platform that allows games and other businesses to create NFTs and blockchain assets for no cost and allow trading of that between their millions and millions of players. So massive scalability, great user experience. And we're talking to both, you know, startups at that, but also some of the biggest billion and $10 billion gaming corporates and conglomerates around the world around building and moving some of their games onto Ethereum.
Yeah, no, Lucas, it's an awesome pivot, and I'll definitely come back into that. I just want to touch on NFTs for a sec. So, I mean, that expression has been around for a while, but I think it's only really been the last 6 months that it's become a thing, you know, and people have probably heard of the NBL's Top Shots and, you know, Beeple selling his digital print for $70 million. And, you know, so NFTs have kind of become this hot thing. We've touched on them in the news podcast a few times and some other stuff, but they have been around for quite a long time. So any observations on NFTs and whether they're a fad or is this something that's going to last?
Awesome. So NFTs are still in early days, and we did see some crazy bubble-like and fad-like mechanics earlier this year. Ultimately, what we have is a new way of having and transferring value. And there have been a lot of people who've tried to do like quick cash grabs along the way, whether it's like, oh, this art or collectible project. And many of them will not last, right? The stuff which happens in hype cycles, normally a lot of people get involved in the space, but about 10% of the projects now are going to be massively game-changing. And this tech is not just going to be, you know, wow, someone sold a piece of art for $70 million, because that doesn't actually change the way that we do things. The technology behind NFTs, so the ability to tell this digital item versus that digital item in a completely trustless way, is likely going to change heaps of industries. So first of all, it's going to completely change gaming for a massive section of video games. It also has the potential to change a lot of financial instruments as well. So there's a lot of legacy infrastructure that tries to make different financial assets be closer and closer to fungible rather than keep them as separate items. Good example would be like you could see a world in which diamonds or crude oil, if you need to know particularly this crude versus that crude or the different barrels between each other, if you have the infrastructure where you can tell them apart, you don't need to have standardized contracts where you know, the quality lines are all blurred and you just need to be at or above a certain quality, but we can get a lot more differentiation between products and financial assets there. So this tech of NFTs over the next 10 years is probably going to redo a lot of entertainment, gaming, and then start seeping over into this finance world as well. It doesn't necessarily mean that spending $1 million on a tweet or on a piece of art is sound financial thinking, though.
Yeah, just to be clear, this is not a statement of financial advice on it. but I mean, it's almost finally has a use been found for. I mean, Bitcoin and the blockchain have been talked about for a long time, and you know, I remember, you know, we've been in the pitch game for a long time, and it must be 5 years ago. Almost every pitch we saw had some mostly bullshit mention of blockchain or Bitcoin within the pitch, just because they thought if they put it in there that you'd get more interest and a bigger valuation. And it's been a while waiting for the actual killer app that's going to come out and demonstrate why the blockchain itself is better than just a standard distributed ledger. I mean, do you think that's true? Is this finally the thing that's going to make blockchain a bit more real and a bit more accepted?
Yeah, look, I'd say that there's two main things which I'm excited by in the world of blockchain, which have the likelihood to give it more and more sticking power. The first one of these is NFTs, which we're working on, which is allowing people to truly own their items. And this is solving a real pain point for gamers, right? And as you were saying before, people would just keep on throwing in the word blockchain as though that is going to make what they're building more valuable. But if you have a look at the Gods Unchained website, so the card game that we have, the word blockchain isn't mentioned on there once. if you need the word, like, to talk about the tech and why the tech is so good as you're talking about this, rather than the product characteristics that the tech allows you to have, then you're not actually building something that's going to be valuable or useful to anyone.
But just before we move on from this, can you just touch on the Bitcoin in particular has this sort of noxious quality about it that is burning the, you know, entire power consumption of Ireland. I think it is. So it's just a crazy amount of power going into this, but not all of it's doing this. And I think I read that Immutable has actually got its climate neutral way of doing it. So why is this better than Bitcoin? And you know, when is blockchain good blockchain and not going to burn up the planet?
Yeah, great question. So Immutable, our platform, is completely carbon neutral. The way we've been able to do this is because we built the world's first zero knowledge roll-up, which essentially means that in the normal, like a single blockchain transaction, instead of only being able to process one trade, and then if you've got millions of players trading with each other, that takes a million times the energy consumption. We've developed a way that we can compress thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of transactions into a single transaction without you needing to trust us about anything. So we use a zero knowledge cryptography or a zero knowledge star, but I won't get too technical in order to do it. But essentially, it means that we can have the same trust and interoperability with the rest of Ethereum and get it security without pushing all this unnecessary computation on it. And it means that it can finally scale to millions. And because we can fit so many transactions into a single Ethereum blockchain transaction, it's very easy for us to then go buy carbon offsets to make sure that it's neutral or even negative.
Yeah. No, I think that's great as well. Because there is a lot of power being used in this stuff. So, and the stuff that we don't necessarily see. I mean, we spend our time in Zoom and online playing games, and it does burn up a lot of power in the back
end. I'd say in about, it's very, like, people are looking at it now. I would say that in about 2 to 3 years, the most of the environmental concerns, not just from stuff that we're doing, but just blockchain industry-wide, a lot of that will have been solved. Because ultimately, consumers demand it. And if people won't put up with a solution that burns the same amount of power as a small country.
No, well, they shouldn't. And I hope they don't. So, all right, let's move on a little bit from that one. I want to come back to the move towards this platform. So, I mean, you kind of moved from being a hit-driven business. I mean, a lot of games publishers are hit-driven businesses. So, you know, think of Activision or Blizzard, I think it's the same thing. I mean, they are churning out games, and if Call of Duty works and, you know, Rock Band 3 doesn't, then they're going to make a big loss. You were doing that, and you had a couple of games. You had Gods of War, Gods Unchained, your Ethereum Battle Bots, and I think you had another one, Guild of Guardians. But you're moving away from that now. So can you just talk a little bit more about that? And are we going to be seeing or not seeing your software in the back end of Steam or Blizzard or any of the big publishers?
Awesome. So we now have two parts of our business. We've got the Immutable Studio and the Immutable Platform. On the Immutable Studio side, we've got a couple of amazing, amazing assets and some of like Australia's and the world's best talent working on that. And that we're growing those teams.
Gods Unchained, yeah?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So we're growing those teams, and the teams have full confidence that they can make those games even bigger and like truly meaning rather than just like great cash creating assets for the rest of the business, like make them globally meaningful games as hits. Then we have the Immutable Platform, which is what we have a huge focus on, and we're currently really spinning up right now. So we are taking this and talking to some of the biggest game publishers and developers in the world around getting their assets and their items and IP to create NFTs on Immutable X and allow their players to trade them. Yeah. This one's pretty exciting to us. These games come with massive like fan bases and they bring their own customers. It's interesting as well because we've had to adapt to just be, you know, a purely B2C focused business. Now we are a B2B and B2B2C focused business. So we're in the process of like creating and ramping up our go-to-market team here and really like decking out the exec bench on this side.
Yeah, I will come back to this question just about how you as an individual have scaled, but the reality is this is a different business to running a studio, which you kind of were before. I mean, how hard has that been to recruit the team and, you know, I suspect enterprise salespeople? I mean, they're a very different breed to a bunch of game developers.
So we were ready for the fact that it was going to be quite a different business before. And we worked out the things that are going to be the same across both, which is our values. Like, we always want to make sure that we are hiring people with the same values across both, and that they have different core assets and different core drivers and different operating models as well. So as we've gone into this B2B world, we knew, right, there's a lot of unknown unknowns here, and we need to bring in some expert help as we start hiring people. And if we get the right first people, then they can bring the rest of their teams and the rest of the people that they know. So been working a lot with my executive coach on exactly what the differences between these two ones are going to be, and having to think about who some of the first hires we're going to need to make or have made in order to start spinning this one up successfully, while also making sure that the games and the studio side can thrive as well.
And okay, in 10 years time then, so when you're worth, I was going to say a billion, but that's probably not enough for you, so call it $100 billion. Is the reason that you're worth that much because of the platform or because of the studio?
Great question. So the investors who we're talking to are largely more excited by the platform side and the opportunity for the platform returns. Essentially, the platform that we're building here for gaming items can easily turn into the everything trading platform. So the way that you can trade everything that's unique digitally. And it can start with, you know, games are huge by themselves. We started by just how big they are compared to the rest of the entertainment industry. But the ability for this platform to allow more things to be traded, like, we've had people approach us and ask, can they create a massive wine vault and, you know, wine cellar, where they take the wine bottles, scan them, turn them into NFTs, and the NFTs trade between people. And if you own the NFT, you can decide if you want to withdraw the bottle of wine, or you can just own the NFT and keep on trading that. And it's a really nice way that you can separate title and the ability to trade and have this world-class trading infrastructure around it from needing to take possession of things.
I know, so, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think owning and running a wine cellar that can keep a $10,000 bottle of wine is not cheap and risky, because someone might steal it. Whereas if you stick it in the Fort Knox equivalent of wine for wine, then it's probably quite a good idea.
Exactly. And there's so many items in the world that people, just in terms of this physical NFT category, there's a lot of items in the world that people want to trade and they want to have exposure to and they want to be able to own, but they don't necessarily want to take custody of with all the costs that are and risks that entails.
Yeah. Okay, this is all amazing. Like, let's talk about funding. And you alluded to this before. You said the investors that we are currently talking to. So I don't think it's a secret that you are out in market raising around right now. And from what I hear, it's going to be kind of around that $100 million mark, which is, I mean, that's a significant round for any Australian business. So I got to ask this question in a way that you're not going to disclose anything, but let me ask the easy one. Like, why are you raising this money and what are you going to use it for?
Awesome. Yeah, look, we'll have more to announce on this front soon. The reason we're raising this is because we have spent all this time developing this product, and it turns out it's a product that people really want. These different businesses, like, we don't even have the internal capacity to respond to all the number of inbounds that we're getting, let alone set up our outbound on a region by region basis to go chatting to different game studios and different opportunities there. So as we build out this GTM team and scale there, as well as continue building out this platform, the funding itself is going to allow us to, like, really hit scale quickly.
And what do you, I mean, like, I think I know the answer. I'll answer it for you. So what are you going to use it for? People? Because, I mean, you have no other assets that you're going to buy. I mean, like, you've got a fancy, expensive office, but I think compared to the staff cost, that's still going to be quite small. But yeah, tell us about the staff that you're going to have to hire and how you're finding that right now.
Awesome. So we are currently, we're in the process of moving from 100 people to 160 by the end of this year is the goal. So we need to go hire 60 more people, which is a endeavor to do so.
Well, some of them might be listening now, so like give them a good plug.
Yeah, fingers crossed. So for us, as you've alluded to, people are not just, you know, the most expensive asset that we have. They're the most important asset. Like all of this has been done by the amazingly talented people that we've managed to bring on at Immutable. And it's not just, you know, high performance people, but a like real culture that we're trying to build here. How can you build one of those great cultures where you have the growth mindset, culture of ownership, people not being afraid to take risks and quickly test and iterate things, and also being able to communicate lovingly and effectively with each other. So with these together, we're looking, right, who do we need at the top as heads of these different functions, and how can we hire people who are way better than us? So having a look, luckily there's been some pretty good Aussie hits recently. If we were trying to do this 5 years ago, I think it would have been a different task. And if we were trying to do this 10 years ago, it would be a different task just in terms of the level of talent that would have existed in Australia. But as we're building out this team, we're also looking at bringing in people from overseas for some of those key roles.
Now I've spoken to, I think it must be 4 founders today and another 3 or 4 yesterday, and all of them are saying the same thing. It's the hiring market is a seller's market right now. So there is a lack of talent, and a lot of people looking for that talent. So there's scarcity. I mean, you're a sexy business and you're raising a lot of money and you can afford to pay good salaries, but there's scarcity, which is driving the price up and the longevity down. I mean, any comments on that?
Look, that's definitely accurate. We want to make sure that, and one of the things that one of our big endeavors over the next year is to make Immutable known as one of the best places you can work. And ultimately, if you want to attract the best people have their choice. So if you are not ultra competitive on remuneration, if you don't have a, not just a good culture, but a really great, appealing culture, if you don't trust people to be able to do their best work and be flexible in their working arrangement, then you won't be able to compete. And this environment, I don't see getting easier. I see it getting tougher and tougher constantly. And businesses need to work out what's their purpose and how can they bring on people who will help drive towards that purpose while also giving different people who work there the best experience possible.
Yeah. It's a tough challenge. And I'll come back to, I do want to touch more about you first. And so let's touch on your background, and then I want to ask you about your development as a leader and as a person. But who are you? So you're based in Sydney, you got a degree from Sydney Uni. Like, just tell us a little bit about you and what you studied and how you got to this point.
Yeah, so I was at Sydney Uni. I studied commerce and law, thinking that I wanted to do something to do with investment banking, mostly, if I'm going to be honest, because that's what my dad did. And then as I finished the business degree, I actually found out what investment banking was and decided that it really wasn't for me. It was a little bit like too transactional, too into details, and I wanted to go make stuff. And decided that what I needed to do was go try and make tech companies. And based on that, I taught myself how to program. So luckily, the whole MIT computer science course is completely online for free. You don't get the certification, but you can go learn all the same content. And I decided to teach myself that over a pretty brutal summer and a bit after I'd finished the business degree.
Wow, so you got a $200,000 US education for nothing.
I honestly did. Like, in terms of the quality.
You probably didn't get the upside of like hanging out and doing sport and drinking with all your mates.
I had enough of that with the commerce degree and the law school.
Yeah. So you finished, like, so you basically just worked out how to do this over the summer.
Yeah. I got a lot of the way over the summer, and then I moved to San Francisco and did another software course and then started working at Silicon Valley tech startups the rest of the year. And over that year, I became pretty good.
I understand. I mean, I think it's fair to say, like, you are quite unique. And I mean, you had the academic prize. I don't know whether you were top of the class, but also in the LinkedIn profile. I was going to ask you about this one because it's just another bunch of words, but the Julius Stone Prize in Sociological Jurisprudence 2016. What the hell is that?
There was a law school subject called sociological jurisprudence, which was like a lot around how social forces can shape the law. And that was a prize for topping that class, mostly based on a pretty interesting essay. This is going niche, but it was an essay around patent law and how like different all the incumbents would use patents as a way of protecting against innovation. Right. So I think I managed to do that one mostly based on passion of actually believing what I was writing rather than being the most diligent law student.
I think you're hiding your talent under a bushel. So let me ask you about a different talent. So the card game Bridge, you ended up playing in the Australian team, if I remember rightly. So, but how, I mean, when you think of Bridge, I think of my mum, or some 80-year-old plus playing double B. I mean, like, how did you get into Bridge and what happened?
So this was I've always loved card games, and I used to play quite a lot of poker growing up. I remember stealing dad's credit card when I was 14 and playing online and against like people who are likely adults, but who knows, maybe we were all 14-year-olds pretending that we were adults. And when I was at university, one of my friends there told me, they're like, look, there's tryouts for the New South Wales Bridge team in about a month's time. He's like, do you want to try out? I'm like, I can't play Bridge. I don't know how to play. And it's like, look, it's not that hard. If you can play different card games, I'll teach you. And we're going to get free trips out of it. We're going to get flown around Australia to play at different events.
With a bunch of 80-year-old women, no?
Well, there's like these 80-year-old people, they loved this game, right? It used to be so big. It was way bigger than poker was. And it was the like game of America. Families would play it. People would play it competitively. And somehow it fell out of vogue. But there's this like very passionate group of 70 and 80-year-olds around this game. And they don't understand why it's like dying. And they've got money to try and support it. And if they wanted to spend that money helping like fly people around me, like me around Australia to go play the game, I was happy to take it.
And so, but how did you get so good so quick?
So I would say focus was the big thing. So we ended up playing quite a lot of Bridge. We also got someone who was even better. There was a class of people at about the same age or a group of people who were even at another level above, and we got them to coach us. So I remember we used to actually, when I was 21, my bridge partner and I would have twice weekly coaching sessions from the best. And when you've got that, you get to skip a lot of those beginner mistakes and get those lessons drilled in from people who know what they're doing.
Right. Yeah, and it should also be added that when you came to Venture Down Under in New Zealand, you took out, I think you were second in the end in the poker tournament.
That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, Melissa Widner took the prize that night. But you hadn't really played that much recently, so I think it was a fairly...
I think my poker career ended when I was 15 years old, right. And Dad found out what I was doing.
Well, yeah, at least he found out. Hopefully he didn't... Were you net up on that?
Net up, which is how I got caught.
Ah, okay. Yeah, I guess it's better than being net down, but still getting caught is not great. Any other secret skills you can tell us about that you don't?
I think those are the big ones. I remember one of my hobbies growing up, obviously, was I played quite a lot of video games, and I remembered like one of the things was I remember my parents saying, "Oh, this is such a waste of time," and one of the things that gives me deep satisfaction is that not just that they were wrong about that, but the fact that video games have just grown from that into this absolute tour de force of like cultural and entertainment you know, this powerhouse that keeps on growing.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. But I also see this with you know, my kids, that you can't play games without any focus. And, you know, there's, I don't mind whatever activity you do, but there is no success in the world without hard work. And so the reality is that, you know, you have put hard work into, whether it's bridge or your career or your whatever else, it's hard work. And, you know, there's no substitute to that.
I think what something which I would maybe add to that is that it doesn't necessarily feel like hard work if you're enjoying it. So in terms of things which I've done better at, it's the ones where you can work hard, you know, pull big days, and it feels like you're almost playing the whole time. Whereas for some other ones, like the commerce degree or the law degree, they felt like a little bit more of a grind for a lot of subjects, and it was a lot harder to work that hard in them.
Yeah, you definitely want to have that sort of sweet spot of enjoyable and productive. So good on you. Let me ask a little bit more about you. So part of the reason that I do know you a little better is because you ended up joining the Summit group. We used to call it Summit Club, but you know, it's a community for late stage founders. So, you know, founders that are worth $20 million or more. So you're way above that now. And you came in the first batch just over 2 years ago. I think there's 19 members in there. I think there's 18 of them still members. And most of them, or many of them, have done amazingly well. I mean, you're certainly in that top echelon that's just gone stratospheric. But why is a group like that important? And why did you join? What did you hope to get? And what have you got?
So joining the Summit Clubs is definitely one of the best decisions that I've made. I found that, especially when I joined, I was pretty green. This was one of the first times that, you know, I'd run a company or a group of people. And there are so many lessons that, regardless of the specific tech niche you're in, just building a tech company, that everyone faces. And they're pretty universal as you try and scale a business. And being able to talk to people who had done it before, were going through similar problems, are looking at problems that you had a couple of months or a couple of, like, a year or so ago, not only allows you to, one, just communicate, sometimes vent, sometimes discuss strategies, but secondly, it's just other people who are doing it as well, rather than thinking that it's all on your shoulders. And being able to have that network of peers has been incredibly valuable, especially like the quality of some of those people, the people in that group, has just been phenomenal to be able to go on this journey and grow with.
Yeah. And I think it's also fair to say, you know, I've been in a similar group for a while. You know, the older you get, the harder it is to make friends and just, you know, get deep with people that you trust and respect. And I think there's definitely some value in that, you know, a lot of founders on the way in that were, you know, when we talk to them about Summit, it's like, oh, it sounds like a huge time commitment. I just don't have time. You know, I don't have time to look after myself, let alone, you know, spend several hours a month and, you know, a few days a year doing. But look, there's a companionship piece. I mean, life is not just about work, and there is more to it. I mean, has that been helpful for you too?
For sure. I'd say it's one of the few environments where you can, in a semi-professional space, be very vulnerable, right? And you don't need to have any particular agenda when you go in. You can just go in there and share and be vulnerable about, you know, these are the things we're doing well. These are the challenges. Has anyone had any of these challenges before? And share and learn based on that. And when people are not coming in with an agenda, it's not a networking event or anything like that. It's a, like, almost closer to a peer support group. And when people are coming into that environment, friendships come fast just because of the level of vulnerability and connection that occurs.
Yeah, look, it's great to hear. You know, it wasn't designed to be a sort of puff piece on it, but definitely when I do chat to Faden about this, which we do a lot all the time, it is the most impactful thing we have ever done at Innovation Bay. And, you know, I came back to the previous point, and one of the most enjoyable. I mean, getting to know people like you and the others in the group has just been so much fun. And it's really, really rewarding. And hearing that feedback is terrific. So thank you.
I would add to it, I would be really interested if you found like a sample group of the company. So we all started at a similar-ish level, right? Everyone was at above that Series A-ish threshold, right? And you were to find a group, a comparable group, who didn't join a group like that, I would be very interested in seeing, because my strong hypothesis is that this group has done unusually well, or like comparably well compared to what other, the typical firm who makes it that size would do.
Right. I think you're right, Louis, and we haven't done the numbers, but you know, if there was such a thing as an index tracker of the performance of Summit Group members, it would far outperform the market, for sure. But some of that, James, might be just self-selecting. I mean, the fact that you are open to joining a group like that suggests that you are open to being, you know, vulnerable. I mean, that's not the reason it's going to work, but open to learning is probably a better way of putting
it. Yeah, the growth mindset. It is a nice, you know, self-selection bias for the growth mindset, for sure.
Yeah. All right, look, we're getting towards the 50 minutes, so I've got just a couple more questions on you. So, like, you work with your brother.
Yes.
Who's quite a bit younger than you, what, 6-7 years?
Four and a half, sorry.
Yeah. How does that work? Is it just the two of you in the family?
We also have a sister who's okay. A doctor who's older than us.
Oh, right. And what does she think of you guys?
She loves what we're doing. We're all very close as a family. She has one of our favorite games that we would play around the dinner table is she would record us sometimes and give us a hypothetical medical patient who walks in and would try and work out what was going wrong with them and just throw out the wrong medical knowledge. And then we got revenge once by getting her to explain blockchain on video, which is just a comedy.
But back to your brother. I mean, Robbie is remarkable. I've met him a couple of times, and he seems as equally talented as you. So how does that relationship work? Because in theory, you're the boss, yeah?
Yeah, look, I think I'm very lucky in a couple of ways. One, that Robbie is so talented at many of the things that I'm not necessarily as talented at. So there's some awesome complementary skills there. And also just that Robbie is so talented outright. So I'd like Peel Fellowship, 99.95, ATAR, blah, blah, blah. Good. And I can just pass him problems. But secondly, also, we have learned some really strong communication skills. There's never any ego. Neither of us really care about position or status as much, especially within the business. The main goal is like somehow we have ended up in one of the most exciting areas you could possibly be building a business in. And our goal is to keep up with it. We know that the challenge is to see how fast we can learn and grow to keep up with this opportunity.
Yeah, that's a great segue to pretty much my last question. Just, you know, so that you talked about the great growth mindset and your ability as an individual, as a leader, as a founder to upskill, because every stage is different. I mean, the stage you're at now, you know, you'll be at 160 staff by the end of the year. But if you fast forward 5 years, you might have 1,000 staff. I mean, and fast forward another 5 years, you might have listed the business. I mean, each of those transition, there is a transition point involved in each, and not every founder makes it through that. It's like the great filter, you know, and people like Mike and Scott at Atlassian or Mel and Cliff at Canva, they have done it. But how do you do it, and how are you confident that you're going to be the right person for the future?
Awesome. Yeah. Look, my big goal is to delegate myself out of a job. If I can't hire people who are better than me, then I'm not doing a very good job. And ultimately, we've got this very clear vision and this very clear strategy, and we've got so many advantages, and we've built a great team so far. And for us to keep up with the opportunity, we need to keep on sticking true to our values, which we as an organization decided very early on what they were and who we wanted to be. And then we need to go hire people who are more talented than us, and they can hire people who are more talented than them, and repeat.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone talks about that, but very few people actually walk the walk, because, you know, it's kind of like a cancer. Like, I mean, that's probably the wrong word to put in there, but if you hire someone who's a B player, they're not going to want to hire people better than them because it's going to make them look bad. But if you hire the A and A plus, they want the A triple plus. But, you know, as soon as you get one B in there, it kind of wrecks it. So that's pretty hard to do.
Across the organization, you need to build that culture, which is like we perform together, we are always open to feedback, but we're always like radically candid with each other and around what the expectations are as well.
Yeah. All right, one last question. And I saw you were in the Forbes 30 under 30. Does that make any difference whatsoever?
I would say maybe like it's a nice signal. I'd say in particular for Robbie, who also was, it's something nice because he never graduated from university. So he dropped out. He was studying computer science and law, and he dropped out of that. And I think just like one of the main points of actually getting a degree is signaling that you have gone and done these things and are qualified in some way. So I'd say for Robbie, it's been sort of nice, but in terms of actual, like ultimately it's a distraction, right? The whole goal is let's go build this incredible business.
Yeah. I used to say awards are for tossers until you win one. all right, let's move on to the quick fire question or questions. I'll be interested, because I haven't heard any of these, so I'll be really interested in your responses. So, any book recommendations?
So, one of my favorite books that I have read recently, or semi recently, maybe a couple of years ago, is the Three Body Problem trilogy. And I'm probably going to butcher the pronunciation of the author. Cheese and Lou, maybe is how you do it, pronounce it. It's a sci-fi trilogy that was recommended. It was on Obama's reading list maybe in 2016. It's his only fiction book that he recommended. I'm like, well, I like fiction. So I'm going to go read that one. And I think it's a fascinating book that has a look at like game theory, has a look at realistically what could it look like if we encountered some other, you know, alien civilization, and then goes in some very interesting directions. And then also, it's one of the first like mainstream books that was originally written by a Chinese author and has since been translated. And it's got this really interesting writing style with it as well. And you can see a lot of just Chinese ideologies come through from it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, we have not had that one recommended before. So that's an awesome one. Podcasts, do you listen to podcasts?
Yes. Yeah, I'm a huge podcast fan. This one is probably one that you have heard many times before. I'm a Tim Ferriss podcast addict. Probably for about 7 years, I've listened to almost every single one. My favorite one, one of my favorite ones recently is the Balaji podcast. So Balaji was the CTO of Coinbase, and he goes and talks about what the future of crypto could mean. Very eloquent, very interesting, goes very deep, doesn't touch any basic level stuff. It's just straight into the advanced stuff.
That was the one on Ethereum, really, yeah. Wasn't it? Yeah, I listened to that one as well. That was great.
Yeah, there was.
I had to concentrate. I had to actually turn down the. Yeah, I normally listen to them in 2x speed, and I couldn't do it with that one. I had to go back.
I ended up listening to it twice.
Right. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I was thinking of you when you were answering those questions earlier. Because of that podcast. Do you have a news source you rely on?
Yeah, so I mostly get, like, my favorite news source is Stratechery by Ben Thompson, which is a paid newsletter, mostly tech strategy. Also a big fan of my other favorite newsletter would be the Matt Levine one in Bloomberg.
Oh, yeah. Is that paid?
No, it's free. I think it's probably the most popular like thing that Bloomberg does, and then they use that to funnel you into trying to pay for that real.
Yeah, no, plus one for Stratechery, and I think it's $10 a month. And you know, some of the stuff he puts out is gold, really, really
clever. Completely. It's like business school strategy for tech companies, and you can take it in, you know, different weekly bites instead.
Yeah, no, that's great. Favorite tech CEO.
So on this one, maybe two, one which lots of people will have heard of, one which people might not have. So the one which everyone would have heard of is Patrick Collison, one of the Stripe brothers, phenomenal, amazing product, amazing ways they're leveraging it as well into different areas of business. The one that people might not have heard of is Sam Bankman-Fried. So Sam Bankman-Fried, or SBF, is the founder and CEO of FTX Exchange, which is a crypto exchange, and Alameda Group, which is a proprietary trading firm in the crypto side. Both of these companies are about 3 and a bit years old. both of these companies are worth well north of $10 billion in that time. So in terms of like phenomenal growth, phenomenal like hyperscaling of some ideas in terms of the revenue side, while also keeping the scale of company size down, like I don't think anyone has done it better.
Yeah, that's great. I had not heard of that. Do you have a favorite app?
Yeah, so my favorite app is Deliveroo by Usig. So this lockdown period has not been good for me. I would probably get Deliveroo 4 or 5 times a week.
Well, it can still be good for you. You can still get healthy food in Deliveroo, can't you?
Yeah, but I don't, Ian. Look, I know I'm not too bad. But there's been only so much fishbowl you can have.
Yeah, no, I get it. Productivity tool. How do you stay productive?
So I think that having a way to tackle email is the most important one. I mean, then just having a way to tackle tasks. So for email, I use something called Polymail. It's pretty similar. There's another one like it called Superhuman, I think. And as long as I'm getting to inbox zero each day and following a very strict process around that, that helps me get through that. And then using, you know, you can use any system, OmniFocus, Trello, Asana, it doesn't really matter. Just following some sort of getting things done, G2D methodology, to actually do tasks and blocking out a big 2-hour chunk per day to do something meaty, so the whole day isn't just meetings, is what I find to be most effective.
Yeah, and I think that is great advice. TV show, that's kind of the opposite of productivity tool, so maybe that's why we ask it after that one. But yeah, do you watch telly?
Yeah, so no telly, all like Netflix and streaming.
I guess that counts.
My favorite one recently would probably be Drive to Survive, which turned me into an F1 fan. you know, you guessed there one day on Netflix being like, oh yeah, I could learn a bit about that. And then now I'm watching it most weekends.
All right, well, that's good. All right, very last question, James. So if you got asked to do a TED talk by the organizers, what would you talk on?
To do something interesting, I'd probably stick to what I know, which would be like, what does it mean for the world in 10 years if we now have programmable, immutable digital assets? What's that going to do? How's everything going to change?
All right. Now that makes perfect sense. Combines passion and knowledge, which is, I guess, your thing. But that's the end, I'm afraid. James, that was awesome. I knew this was going to be a good one. I knew you're a pretty remarkable individual. So look, congrats on the progress so far. Thanks for being part of the Innovation Bay community. And good luck with the future. And let us, if anyone wants to get in touch or wants a job, like what's the best way for them to get in touch?
Awesome. So yeah, we are hiring for about 60 roles. The best way to do it is to go to immutable.com, and then there's a link to careers.
Fantastic. All right. Well, let's leave it at that. But James, thank you so much. And good luck with the future.
Thanks, Ian. A pleasure.